Haven't seen you in a week. Chris had someplace to go. Good trip? Great. Cold? Hmm? Not too bad, huh? Good. Did you have a good time on Tuesday, Josh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great.
On the bus all day.
You were.
Yeah.
Jordan's back too. Hadn't seen him in about a week.
Who?
Jordan. He disappeared with you.
Oh, yeah.
He went someplace.
Yeah.
Not quite sure where he went.
Out from last week.
Probably the only professor you guys will ever have that'll remember whether you're in class or not in class. I don't know whether that's positive or negative. Let me wrap up some announcements. Have some fun today. There's a lot of handouts today dealing with the haplotype map that we will get to on the second part of today's class session. And this is pretty fascinating stuff, as you will see, hopefully in about 30 or 40 minutes. But you have some information on the HapMap project, which is a big deal, as you'll see. You have some information on this Genographics project, which is fascinating, sponsored by IBM and National Geographic, that I'll talk a little bit about today. And you have some things about the origins of human populations and ancestry, which is just getting to be one of the most fascinating areas of science that you can ever, ever, ever imagine. And in fact, if you go to the National Geographic's website and you go to the Genographics Project, as we'll talk about, and I'm getting ahead of myself, you can send in a little buccal swab, just like you did in class, and you'll get back a complete lineage of where you came from and how your ancestors migrated from their origins in Africa, which is pretty fascinating. Next week's discussion articles you should also have, and that will be the apex of discussions because you'll be dealing with genetic engineering of humans, and that's a pretty serious issue. And so all the things that we've been talking about in this class in terms of genetic engineering, in terms of preparing you conceptually, leads up to the ultimate, which is using this technology on human beings. And that will be, I think you'll find, a very fascinating discussion in which Mike and Gloria are going to really spend a lot of time wrapping up a lot of ethical issues, probably at least an hour of next week's discussion. And so when you think about this technology and you think about engineering humans, it gets to be very controversial. Reminder that there's a meeting tomorrow at the HC70 AL Lab, 3 p.m., down my hallway in the conference room for those of you who are taking it. What's coming up next? You have quizzes 7 and 8 due tomorrow night. Final oral exam. There it is. You'll be getting it at the end of class today. Don't forget to pick it up. As promised, there's 5 new questions and 2 that'll be old that you don't have here that you'll find out when you come next week. But there it is. And then you have class project due next week. And I don't know why I duplicated that. And then there'll be quiz 9 next week. So that will be it. Now, one of the most fascinating things that's going to happen next week is Greg's doc. As I told you, he's going to come and he's been driving Jessica nuts. David's back, too. He's been driving Jessica nuts all quarter and before, changing the time about 26 times, bringing his entire entourage with him, and having to have a big suite in the W Hotel. I shouldn't have said that. In any case, which I don't mind, isn't that correct? Anyways, Greg is quite an amazing guy, which I'll come to in a second. There he is. So we're going to have a reception for him not on Thursday, but on Tuesday, which goes to show where I am today. So there's going to be a reception on Tuesday and a dinner, and the dinner will be in Westwood for those of you that are scheduled. And please RSVP with Jessica. He's very, very, very provocative. He's very soft-spoken, but he's very provocative, as you will see. So who is this guy? Well, Greg Stock is a professor in the School of Public Health here at UCLA on leave, and he is on leave because he founded a biotechnology company called Signum Biosciences in Princeton, New Jersey, with his brother, who is a professor of molecular biology in Princeton. But he's a really fascinating guy, because what you can see is he has an undergraduate degree from Johns Hopkins in biophysics, he has a PhD from Johns Hopkins in biophysics, and he has an MBA from Harvard. So he's a pretty smart guy. He's written many, many books, which I'll show you in a second, and they're really fascinating. I mean, this guy is a fascinating guy. Some of the best discussions I've had in the last few years have been with Greg, because he's a thinker, and he thinks to the future, and he thinks logically, and as you will see. And so he's won some book awards, and he had a book which was the number one bestseller on the New York Times book list, which is no small task. And what are the books that he's written? All of those. And so he's written this book called Redesigning Humans, which is the inevitable future of human beings, which is a very thought-provoking book. He's written these books of questions. If you ever have a chance to pick up the Book of Questions, this first one up here, it's really quite an amazing thing to read. And this was a New York Times bestseller. And then he adapted it for kids, relationships, business, all kinds of stuff. But they're fascinating reads because he poses incredible questions which cause you to really think about what you're doing. But for our purposes, he's written Redesigning Humans, he's written MetaMen, and he's been involved in a book on engineering the human genome. So he's going to talk about all the things that we've talked about in class relative to human beings, but he's going to, you'll see, his thesis is going to be, it's all going to happen, so why even worry about it? That's basically going to be his thesis, and so what? What's the big deal? Everyone's focusing on all the wrong issues, as you will see. And so be prepared for Greg, because I think it's a privilege to be able to get him here, and it's a privilege to be able to have him here and be able to have him contribute to this class and discuss and everything else. He's a fascinating guy, as I said. You'll see. Quiet guy, soft-spoken guy, fascinating. Let me go over this final oral exam again just one more time, because you'll have it and you'll have to prepare for it. So I just want to make sure you understand it, and then we'll move on. It's much like what you had a week ago. As I said on Tuesday, I'm repeating myself, but there are some variations here. You will pick one question from the quizzes. Actually, I'll pick it for you, so the group that picks the quiz question will pick the quiz that I pick. You'll pick one question from the take-home exam. I'll have pre-picked that one, and if you draw that one, it'll be the question that I have pre-picked from the take-home exam. And then there's five new questions with they're very comprehensive, you'll see. Each one is interspersed with science and genetic engineering and the law and legal issues and all kinds of things like that. So each of these questions that are new have 5 to 6 to 7 parts. And so the way it works is that you'll come in presumably prepared because you have the questions in advance. Hopefully you'll get together and do that. And you will pick the questions and then divide into the groups that we will pre-assign you. These will be different groups than you had for your midterm fail-safe oral exam. It'll be totally different. Inevitably, you might be with one or two or three of the same people, but there'll be different groups. And then you'll have 15 minutes to prepare your questions, and then you'll come back in, and there'll be exactly 12 minutes, and we will stick to time because there's a lot of things to do a week from Thursday, and there's a class that follows this class, and so unfortunately we can't go overtime as we've done in the past. And so you'll have 12 minutes, 8 minutes for the answer question, and 4 minutes for the challenge. Everyone in the group must participate. In other words, like you did, and you did a great job, as I've said many, many, many times. Everyone, you know, takes the microphone and passes from one to the other. You get essentially 3 grades. You'll get a group grade on the answer. You'll get a group grade on the challenge. And you'll get an individual grade on your part of the oral exam. And the total number of points is like 150,000 or something like that. But that's how it works. And again, pick it up at the end of class so you can start working on it. There's really nothing in that final oral exam, even though you haven't seen these questions, there's really nothing in those questions you haven't seen. And so whether it's in quizzes or whatever, so it's not that you're going to have to go to the library and do all kinds of new stuff, quite the contrary. And so are there any questions on anything related to that? Anton, does that make you happy?
Quite so.
You sure?
Yes.
Positive? Never been happier in your entire life?
Never.
Never? Neither have I. I'm always happiest when I'm in this classroom, believe it or not. Okay. There we go. I wound up on Tuesday, not quite with it. I wound up on Tuesday talking about the history of laws that deal with genes, the history of laws that deal with DNA. And as I said on Tuesday, the historical context goes back to the beginning of the 20th century, just for a reminder. And I said that those laws manifested themselves in many different ways, primarily in the sterilization laws by the states promoting the public welfare, promoting the general welfare, and also manifested themselves in terms of immigration policy, indirectly, but it's still the same kind of thing. And I also said that those laws really got tragically adopted by the Nazis in Germany, which was really the first and only, thank God, state-sponsored genocidal program of what would be called racial purity. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later on today in terms of the false science and everything that went into that from a scientific perspective. And then I also said that after that, all of the laws in the United States of forced sterilization were overturned. And, of course, those things don't exist anymore. But I wound up by saying, in a big surprise, at least for me and I hope for you, was that there are still these eugenics laws on the books. And the 1995 People's Republic of China, you know, their marriage law, also propagates what would be called good genes versus bad genes, and there's provisions in this law to advise couples to be sterilized. There's provisions in this law to advise couples to abort the fetus if they deem it to be mentally defective, whatever that is, shades of Buck versus Bell. But the difference is that there's no penalties. No one's going to jail because they don't observe these things. But, you know, there's a lot of state and social pressure, and so even though you don't have a penalty, perhaps many people would be persuaded because of these laws to have some kind of genetic purity, whatever that means. I also gave you a couple handouts that dealt with an explanation of those laws, and I'm not going to go into it, but the point that I want to make here is simply that different cultures and different societies look at these issues in different ways, and if you think about it from the point of view of a well, let's say from a Confucius point of view, just some of the reading that I've done, they consider a child to be live when it's born, and it's not really a living being before it's born. And so therefore, a lot of the tradition of how this eugenics law was constructed in China comes out of Confucius tradition, religious tradition in China, in terms of when they think the baby's alive and when it's not a human being and when it's not a human being. And that really has influenced that particular law in many, many ways. So that means that with the new DNA testing, with all the powerful tools that are being used, it raises a number of different issues, And I'm not going to go over these issues in depth because you've talked about them, I think, both directly and indirectly at some point during this class. But the key here is that one wants to construct barriers to prevent any misuse of your genetic information, any misuse of this information that would cause any kind of discrimination, outcasting, or whatever, or coercion in terms of using this genetic information in any way, shape, or form. And therefore, there's been a big movement in the United States and elsewhere In order to get legislation passed, as you will see, that protects many of your genetic rights. And I'll talk a little bit about that. And I'm not going to go into all the different things, but I'll talk in general about them. In reality, in the United States, this is really not so much of a problem. Because if one considers a genetic defect, so to speak, a disability in some way, we're protected, as you'll see, in so many different ways that it's really not really a huge problem. But theoretically, you're dealing with what could possibly be a problem rather than what the reality is. We're pretty sophisticated. I think I told you that many years ago, people in wheelchairs couldn't get into buildings. People who were hearing impaired had to go to special schools. They still do, but voluntarily. We live in a very different society where we mainline people with disabilities. They're very accepted in society, and people with genetic disabilities would fall into the same realm. So it's a very different ball game than it was 100 years ago. Nevertheless, there are issues. Issues like, why screen for genes? What about the accuracy of the tests? That's very important because you don't want to give false information. What do you do with the information? What do you do with the information if the disease doesn't manifest itself till you're 50 or 60 or 70 years old? How do you make those decisions? How do you protect the privacy and confidentiality of this information? How do you protect against any kind of discrimination? What are the obligations of the physicians to inform you that there's a genetic test? What's your obligation if you know you have, let's say, a lethal Huntington's disease gene, to tell your sisters or brothers that you have this gene? What are your obligations? There's many, 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 many issues that deal with genetic screening, employment discrimination, health insurance, all kinds of things. But as you'll see, I think we're pretty much protected as much as we can possibly be. There may be people that don't think that we are, but my view is I think we're reasonably protected. And the question becomes, in terms of the law and genetics, how can these laws be enacted? I think you know about this because I covered it in glowing detail a few weeks ago, but it's clear that we have this thing called promoting, you know, the general welfare. We have the police power. So the federal government, therefore, can pass laws that deal with, you know, discrimination and all kinds of other things under this promoting the general welfare. The states can do the same because of the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, that is, powers not specifically delegated to the federal government or left over to the states. The states, therefore, can promote the general welfare because it's in their constitutions, and therefore the states have police powers to enact laws that deal with, you know, discrimination in the workplace, discrimination in health insurance, using embryos for research. All of these things falls under the context of promoting the general welfare and the police powers of either the federal government or of the state governments. But clearly there's other things that we talked about, and this is obviously a review. You have the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, prevention against unreasonable searches and seizures. You're going to see that that isn't always absolute. Hopefully I'll be able to get there a little bit. You have the Fifth and 14th Amendments to the Constitution, which is right, liberty, and property and person without due process of law. That's the privacy issues. You have a number of these things in which laws can be enacted that deal with genes and DNA, criminal laws, and also tort, non-civil wrongs. So there's a whole tradition here of court cases and precedents that don't deal necessarily specifically with DNA and with genes, but which can be applied to the realm of genetic testing, DNA, DNA databases, confidentiality, protection, liability. All of these different kinds of things can come home to roost under these. And there'll be more and more and more and more as time goes on. So what about in the federal realm? There's no national law dealing with genetics. I'm going to say that again. There's no national law dealing with genetics. There's no law that says you have the right to your, you know, genetic privacy. There's no federal legislation. There's no federal legislation on cloning. There's no federal legislation on stem cells. There's executive orders. As you know, President Bush's executive order prohibiting use of federal funds for stem cell research. There's other executive orders, but there's no legislation. But there's legislation that's pending, but it hasn't been passed. Daisy, yeah? That was your hand, wasn't it? Yeah.
Do executive orders end after the current president leaves term? Mm-mm. So can the next president, like, say they can stop?
Well, remember I told you that Papa Bush had the executive order that says you couldn't use federal funding for embryo research?
Yeah.
And Clinton came in and said, too bad, I'm rescinding this executive order. And then baby Bush came in and said, well, I'm going to put it back into play. And so, yes. And how do they do that? They do that under federal funding. Remember, one of the ways to regulate science indirectly is to the power of the purse. And the power of the purse in the federal government is the Department of Human Health and Human Services. That's where NIH is. And that's in the executive branch because Congress has passed a law saying that you could have this Department of Health and Human Services, and under the Department of Health and Human Services is the NIH, and that's a part of the executive, and therefore the executive administers it, and the executive can decide who might get federal money for research and who might not. So it's a president-specific rule. It only deals with funding. Doesn't deal with anything in any legal sense. And as you know, and I think I said this or I may have forgotten, you have no constitutional right, unfortunately, to have research funds. I wish you did, because then those of us who do science wouldn't have to write grants all the time, but we don't. Any other questions? Sure? Okay. So we have some things that deal with genetics, and I'm not going to go over these things in depth because you can read them and you can research them and you can learn them. I'm just going to give you a broad outline and a broad stroke, but we have this Clinton executive order. And the Clinton executive order prohibits the use of any genetics, any DNA testing, anything dealing with genetic information, protects confidentiality for federal employees. So this deals for all federal employees, all employees of the federal government. The federal government who employs these people cannot use genetic information, DNA testing, anything in any way, or discriminate on the basis of whether someone's a carrier or someone, you know, has full sickle cell anemia or whatever. It's an executive order. And this is really the closest thing we have for preventing genetic discrimination in the federal workplace. So this is Clinton's executive order of 2000, which is still in place. Now, I said there's many bills that have been introduced that deal with genetic discrimination in insurance and genetic discrimination in employment. These have been endorsed by the Bush administration. They are bipartisan bills. They've been introduced by both Democrats and Republicans. I can't go into the history of why these things haven't been passed. Your guess is as good as mine. These are very complex bills. There's a lot of special interests at play. But the fact of the matter is that these bills have not been passed, even though there is a lot of bipartisan support. On the other hand, there are laws that deal with genetics, and I've mentioned some of them, but they deal with them indirectly. But you could interpret them as applying to someone who might have some genetic disease or some genetic disability, and this is the Americans for Disability Act of 1990, which was a monumental act. Every business in the United States complained and moaned and rolled over and said that the world was going to come to an end because they were going to have to construct businesses which were barrier-free and allow people in wheelchairs to get into bathrooms and to get into the building and hire people with disabilities. And I can assure you that most of the business community was not very much in favor of this because they were concerned about costs. On the other hand, look at what it's done for society in terms of mainlining people that have disabilities and how wonderful it is that these people can get into classrooms and can get into buildings and can be employed even though they aren't as able to do things physically and in some cases otherwise as we can. And so one could technically then classify someone with a genetic defect, quote unquote, a genetic disability, a gene which prevents them from doing something, you know, in a way in which someone else could do it. One could qualify theoretically if they were discriminated against under the Americans for Disability Act, which says that you can't discriminate against anyone under any circumstance if they have a disability. That does not mean, however, that you have to give them a job that they're not suited for. It just means that you can't discriminate against them or you can find another job that they are suited for. So keep that in mind. So that's the ADA Act 1990. Then there's this thing called HIPAA. And HIPAA was something which was really a source of contention, because the health insurance industry and the hospitals thought the world was going to come to an end if Congress passed HIPAA. But in a sense, what HIPAA is the Health Insurance Portability Act. And what it really says is, in a nutshell, with respect to genetics, and I'm not going to go into its complexities because I'm not a health insurance lawyer, nor do I want to be, but it basically says that you can't use a genetic disability as a basis of excluding someone from a group health insurance policy. And you can't use it as a pre-existing condition. In other words, if you have a health insurance policy, and let's say you have sickle cell anemia, or you have cystic fibrosis, or some other genetic disease, you cannot be excluded from a group insurance policy, and you can transfer your insurance ability if you go to another worker and if you go to another group insurance policy. But generally, it applies only to group policies, and it doesn't apply to private policies. So this does not apply if you want to buy an insurance policy for, you know, medical purposes on your own. It applies to group policies, but it's very important. Because it basically says that genetic diseases are really no different than any other disease, and it protects the confidentiality of the genetic information as it does with all other medical things. So a second part of the HIPAA Act is it ensures the privacy of all your medical information in the hospital. And that was something that the hospitals screamed and moaned and said it's going to cost them a fortune. But hell, do you want your medical information being given out freely to other people? No, not at all. And so that's why you got all these little privacy things. You may have not, but your parents did, said that you had to sign something that said they can't release your information without your permission. Uditha.
What is a...
I can't hear you.
What is a group insurance policy versus, like what does that mean, a group insurance policy?
A group insurance policy is a policy probably that you have that you get from an employer generally, in which your employer offers all the employees in your company or your university or in your school the same plan, as opposed to an individual. If you just called up Blue Cross Blue Shield in California, let's say here locally in Los Angeles, you said, I want an individual health insurance policy, you're going to be able to get one, but it's going to be much more costly because when you have a group insurance policy, you're averaged over the whole group. So if someone is very seriously ill, it's not going to really make a big effect because most people are healthy, and the healthy people essentially pay for the ones that are very, 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 very sick. Okay, so we have the HIPAA, both in terms of the portability and in terms of privacy, and those are very important. And then, of course, we have this very important Great Society, I will say that, Great Society law, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, enacted under the presidency of Lyndon Baines Johnson, who I also must confess, why not, gave the graduation speech when I graduated from college and announced part of his Great Society, which has become a little bit in disfavor in certain segments of our current society. But if you think about all the things that were done, like the Civil Rights Act, which prevented people from being discriminated against on the basis of race and all other things, one can infer that genetics would apply here. So I think there are some protections here that we have against genetic discrimination. Even though there isn't one specific law per se, I think that there are some laws that could be applied, certainly with discrimination in the workplace and other things that are on the books in terms of federal legislation. And I also would predict that one of these bills, and I pulled this up from the Democratic Policy Committee website. Don't read anything into that, by the way. It's just the first hit that came up on Google. In any case, this is the bill, bipartisan bill, that's before Congress now. It's just been the same bill that's come up from 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, and it's really its provisions are to protect against genetic discrimination in employment and insurance and ensure privacy of genetic discrimination. And if you want to get that thing passed, write your congressperson, because they're going to be very, very, very much concerned with that. Now, most of the laws that deal with genes and genetics and DNA and all the things that you've talked about regarding forensics and crime and all of that stuff are state laws, okay? So, whereas there's no federal legislation, there is an abundance of state legislation dealing with genes, dealing with DNA, dealing with genetic discrimination in employment, in the insurance, in disability insurance, health insurance, life insurance, workplace, anything that you can imagine under the sun, and dealing with research on stem cells, and dealing with research on human embryos, and dealing with research on fetuses, and dealing with selling embryos or selling eggs. I mean, anything you can imagine under the sun is in the purview of the states. And I will also say that it's a hodgepodge. And what I mean by that, it's state-specific. And many states differ dramatically for what they protect compared to other states. And many states permit things that other states don't permit, depending upon what the legislature has passed or the people, because many of these things, particularly in California, are in our Constitution due to our illustrious initiative and referendum system, these propositions that you vote on. So if you're interested in any law from any state, and I'm not going to go through these in depth, you go to the National Council of State Legislatures. That's where it's all at. That's the key. If you want to know anything about any law dealing with anything concerning any of the states, there's this National Conference or Council on State Legislatures. They have a website, and one of the subsets of this website is on genetics and DNA, and you can pull that up and you can find anything, as you will see in a second. And so there's laws dealing with fetal research, employment, frozen embryos, I mean, licensing, genetic counselors, health insurance, human cloning, all of these different kinds of things, including newborn screening. And if you pull up the one from the state of California and you follow all of the links, although they're not very, very easy to follow, you will get 4.5 pages of, well, you'll get 4 pages of California laws that deal with genetics, cloning, DNA, genes, stem cell, fetal research, and there's every single solitary California law in these 4 pages that one could ever go to. And if you press the link, you'll get the absolute exact law. And so I've gone through all of these things, believe it or not, and I tried to condense it a little bit for you, but there they are in a nutshell. And that is really the things that are dealing with newborn screening, dealing with protection in the workplace, dealing with protection against for discrimination in employment, dealing with stem cell research, the new proposition which was passed just last year or 2 years ago, dealing with anything dealing with genes, screening, heredity, anything is in these chapters and in these laws, and I've printed out some of them for you. These are not anything dealing with criminal DNA databases or any of that stuff, which I'll get to in a second, but the point here is that it's a state-by-state basis, state-by-state legislation. Some of it fascinating, some of it quite boring, but it differs from state to state. So we're only going to talk about California. I can't talk about Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana and Florida because it's all different. But yet it's fascinating in terms of how these different states and different regions come up with stuff. And so let's just go through some of these things just conceptually. Some I'll talk more about than others, but let's just follow, what I've put together for you. So the first issue is cloning, because that deals with genes, obviously. Are you able to clone yourself or perpetuate your own genotype? What could be more in tune with dealing with genes than doing that? Would you agree, Charles? I mean, that's the ultimate, obviously, in terms of dealing with genes, replicating your own genotype directly. In the state of California, reproductive cloning is banned. No one is allowed legally to clone themselves reproductively. On the other hand, therapeutic cloning is allowed. And you know the difference between reproductive cloning and therapeutic cloning because Gloria and Mike went over that with you in discussion. So we can undergo therapeutic cloning. You can make a clone of yourself up to the blastocyst stage. You can extract your stem cells up from the blastocyst stage, from the inner cell mass. That's all permissible in the state of California, but in other states it's not. But you can do that. And research can be done on those tissues. Okay, and that deals with the next series of laws, and that is that In the state of California, one can do research on human embryos, but not research on aborted embryos or fetuses. In other words, ones that have come from voluntary abortions, but spontaneous abortions or from in vitro fertilization, gotten any of those ways, embryos and fetal tissues can be the subject of investigation, obviously for medical reasons. The embryos can't be bought and sold. The fetuses can't be bought and sold. You can't do a trade in eggs. You can't do a trade in any of these things. That's outlawed by California law. But you can, in fact, deal with making stem cells from yourself or getting it from other individuals. It's all permissible in the state of California. However, there are many, 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 and Michelle Evans talked about these, there are many restrictions on what you can do. And they're not really restrictions, but there's some legal protections in terms of how the material is handled, the permission that has to be obtained. You have to get patient permission. You have to get the people who donate these things permission. And there has to be a lot of legalities in terms of what the physician has to inform you that you have the right to do or not to do. And all of that is in the next few pages that I'm not going to go over, obviously, but it's the California Health and Safety Code 125300 all the way down to 125320, and that's basically where it is. And Michelle Evans talked about this, that if you undergo in vitro fertilization, it's all in this law. The physician must, before they are allowed to do that procedure, as you can see here, inform you, and you must choose what you're going to do with the embryos. And it says, for example, in the event of death of either the male or female partner, the embryos shall be disposed of in one of the following actions, as you can see, made available to the living partner, donated for research purposes, thawed with no further action taken, thawed, donated to another couple or other disposition that's clearly stated, and then it goes on in the event of death of both partners, and then it keeps going on, and you can read it. But the point here is that even if you decide to donate them to research, you have to be informed then of where they're going to, and that's in the last part of this law. And if they're going to go to research, it means the people that are going to use them for research can't implant them, the intact embryo, in another woman. And it only can go to research, and it only can be used to make stem cells and things like that. And it's very strict in terms of how this is governed, as it should be. So those are the laws in the state of California dealing with cloning and therapeutic cloning, in vitro fertilization, and the resulting embryos and stem cells. It's very, very specific. It's highly specified. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. And each state has their own set of rules. Yes, Yuditha.
Even though stem cell research isn't federally funded, can a state choose to fund it?
Well, the state of California, I think you talked about this in discussion, the state of California funded $3 billion for stem cell research, of which a significant fraction is going to UCLA, and this was something that was voted on just maybe a year ago. And it's the biggest bond measure that was voted for medical research almost in history. And it's tied up in the courts, but it'll be released, and UCLA is getting at least $100 to $200 million of this. And in fact, every stem cell researcher in the world is migrating to California because there's $3 billion of research money that they can use. And in many other parts, they can't get federal research grants, so where else can you go? So we discussed this, that you can use state money and you can use private money to carry out stem cell research. You simply can't write a grant for the federal government. Okay, now, there are other laws that deal with all kinds of issues dealing with genetics, primarily with DNA screening. And I'm not going to go over these in glowing detail, as I said, but clearly there are some precedents, and I'm going to go over them a little bit just to give you some conceptual background. So clearly there's the newborn screening laws, and I've actually given you those laws, which I'll get to in a few minutes, in California. But as I said on Tuesday, this goes back to Robert Guthrie in testing for phenylketonuria in the blood of newborn babies. And the bottom line here is all states, as you will see, have mandatory newborn screening laws, every solitary state in the United States. The number of diseases that they screen for differs from state to state. And I've given you a big list of that in your handout, and I'm not going to go over it. But the legal precedent is, again, promoting the general welfare. Now, mandatory testing of all newborn infants is permissible and has been enforced. And the only exception, and it's kind of vague, actually, because I really researched the exact wording, and you have it, the only exception is on the basis of religious preferences. However, it can't be, oh, my religion is against this, I'm not going to allow you. It has to be something which is serious, and it has to be something purposeful, and it has to be something that's, you know, part of your religion. Although I will say that the state has an overreaching right to protect the welfare of the child. And so there's been many cases in which individuals that practice particular religious practices, I should say, have not allowed their children to be treated for cancer or stuff like that, and the state has just intervened because the child is going to die. So this is not an absolute. And so there is an exception, but the exception has a very high bar that you have to meet. And if you put this child in danger, like if you refuse to test for phenylketonuria, the child is going to become mentally retarded and not do very well, then the state probably has the right to step in and say, too bad, this child has rights too. And we have the state's welfare, the child's welfare concern, and that's what the state is for. And so it's not an absolute, depends upon the seriousness, and depends upon a case-by-case basis. So clearly, mandatory testing. So newborn screening is the only laws in the United States of America that allows and requires mandatory testing for specific genes. That is a big deal. I don't want you to, you know, take that lightly. That is a big deal. And it's going to get to be more and more as we discover more and more disease genes and these tests become cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. On the other hand, child-adult testing is voluntary, obviously. Because if you're required to test as an adult or a child and there's no cure and nothing that you could do with the information, why would anyone want to have mandatory testing? And in that instance, it would violate the 5th and 14th Amendments of the Constitution. No question about it. Might even violate the 4th Amendment in terms of unreasonable searches and seizures. But the point here is that there are protections in the federal Constitution and state Constitution against mandatory testing beyond newborns, because in those instances, one can't do anything with the information. You can't, you know, cure the disease, or, you know, you can probably treat it, but it has to be voluntary. And there are laws that also say that if the child is tested, because the parents want the child to be tested, when the child turns age 18, they must be given that genetic information. Agree with that, Nick?
Sounds good.
Disagree with it?
No.
You're sure? Taking lots of notes on this? In any case, the point here is that we have these protections against adult and child testing. And I think here, and you have so many protections against confidentiality and everything, that I don't think we have to worry about it. I think that the major issue here, the bone of contention, is the use of this information in reproductive planning. And I think that's really the key. And I think the key is that no one's going to, you know, disagree with me or Ben or Radina or Josh or Lisa or anybody in this room of saying, okay, I think my child has some symptoms and, you know, they might be some kind of genetic disease. I want to have that child tested. That's a voluntary thing. I don't think anyone's going to disagree with that because it may help be able to treat the child in some way. And I don't think anyone's going to disagree that, you know, if you wanted to be tested voluntarily or if I did or anyone else, you can do that. And, of course, with all the confidentiality and privacy concerns, and that we're all probably in agreement that we don't want to have any mandatory genetic testing whatsoever. We don't have any, you know, DNA databases that deal for these kinds of things and all of that kind of stuff that I could get into in much more depth. But I think that the real controversial issue, let's just cut to the chase here, is what do you do with information of infants, you know, that are either pre-implanted, as we just talked about, blastocysts, which have been tested, you know, or even before in the Morula stage, eight cell stage, or amniocentesis, 16 weeks, or amniocentesis, 20 weeks, chorionic villi, you know, sampling at 16 weeks. What do you do with that information? And that's the key. And furthermore, the other key is what happens if the physician or the genetic counselor or whomever doesn't tell you that there's a genetic test that you could have had, and you give rise to a child that's very severely disabled genetically, but there was a test and you didn't know about it. That's clearly, clearly a problem and of concern. And so the first concern really is nothing that we can really discuss, because right now under the laws of the United States of America and our Constitution, it's the woman's choice, at least up to the first trimester. And so the reproductive decisions that a woman makes are her own, and those reproductive decisions follow according to Roe v. Wade. Whether that changes or not is a whole other matter, but the fact of the matter is that's the way it is right now. And I suspect that if it changes, it'll never change in the state of California, and it'll be on a state-by-state basis. But that's the bottom line. But that reproductive choice, as we've talked about a little bit in here, is going to spill over to a lot of other things. As more and more cloning technology becomes more sophisticated, and as, let's say, the probability of being able to get a healthy child becomes more and more and more as technology advances, then things like prohibition against cloning yourself may come up with court challenges, or the culture may change, just as in vitro fertilization was not allowed prior to 1972. Now it's just a common thing. Societies change as technology changes, but who knows? On the other hand, what about if you want to have a child and let's say your significant other is pregnant, and or a woman is pregnant without a significant other, it doesn't really matter, carrying a child, and the child gives birth and has a genetic disability that's very serious, but there was a test for this, and the woman or the couple could have known. And that's where it hits the fan, so to speak, because now it comes under what's called tort liability. And tort liability is a big issue in medicine these days. It's a big issue because in many states they don't have protection against tort liability. That is, physicians can be sued for as much as you want. And in those states, there's a shortage of many, many, many physicians because they just won't go to those states because they can't afford malpractice insurance, particularly OBGYNs and brain surgeons. But I'm not going to get into that little tangent. On the other hand, there's been many instances of parents that have sued their physicians, or children that have sued their parents under what is known as wrongful birth or wrongful life suits. And they're slightly different. Wrongful life is that I shouldn't have been born because the quality of my life is miserable and I should have been terminated or not even conceived. Wrongful birth is a different issue in which someone might have known that there was a genetic test and you give rise to a child with a very severe genetic disability, and they sue for wrongful birth because they should have known. And so generally wrongful life suits are children against parents. Wrongful birth suits are generally parents against physicians. Now there's a hodgepodge of laws in the states that deal with this. Some states prohibit all wrongful life and wrongful birth suits. So that means that if the physician doesn't, for example, tell you or just forgets to tell you that there's a genetic test and the child has a very serious genetic disability, in those states that have protection against these laws, you have no remedy. You have no tort remedy. You have no remedy whatsoever. Other states, you may have a remedy, and there are some precedents. So one can't argue one way or the other, but the fact of the matter is there's a lot of history behind this. goes into the abortion controversy. It gets into all kinds of different issues that I don't want to go into. But there are precedents in state law to protect individuals, protect physicians and others, genetic counselors, from being sued because of this. And in other cases, there aren't. So it's just state by state. Who had a question? Charles?
Yeah. Hello.
Think you should have the right to sue your parents because they gave birth to you and you're not as smart as, you know, you wanted to be?
Is this on? Oh. Now, the problem I had with that was you said earlier how there's, like, there's the HIPAA rule, or is that what it's called?
The what?
The HIPAA. Mm-hmm. The HIPAA rule, where it said you couldn't, like, discriminate based on genetic, like, diseases.
In healthcare.
Right.
In healthcare.
But then it's like...
In healthcare, you can't prevent someone from getting health insurance, period.
Okay. Well, all right.
Yeah, it doesn't apply in this case.
Okay. Well,
it has
saying,
nothing
like,
to do with it.
It's like they're getting, like, not the best of both worlds, but it's like you can't discriminate them, and then they can sue you for that. It's like,
tort liability. It's a whole different body of law. Any other questions? What do you think, Chris? You think kids should be able to sue their parents? Child's born, has severe muscular dystrophy, is on a respirator, the quality of life is miserable, it has Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, there's a test that's been around for 20 years, the parents said, too bad, I'm not going to test, history of muscular dystrophy in the family, child's born, he's living on a respirator, he's basically being supported by the state because the parents can't support the child, there's no way. He says, you know, I'm suing you. Wrongful life. My quality of life is miserable. I would have been better off if I wasn't born. You're going to pay. That's what we're talking about here. That's a wrongful life suit.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, said that.
What do you mean you don't know? You know something.
I don't know.
What do you
much.
Mean you don't know? You know a lot. What do you know?
It seems like a good thing.
Good thing, huh?
Yeah. I'm okay with it.
Who do you think would be in favor of those kinds of suits, and who do you think would be against it?
The child would be for it. The parents would be against it.
What contingencies do you think in society would be against those kinds of suits?
Depends. It depends on where in the legal system the precedents reside. Right, if it's something funded by the state, I can imagine there are certain facts, right? So that would be okay because there's not the federal government imposing these kinds of things. So there are certain political factions that might be okay.
Well, an individual who would be against such a suit would want the child to be born.
Regardless. Mean like religious conservative? Oh, okay, yeah.
People who would be against those kinds of suits would want the child to be born regardless of the deformity or disability and whatever. I'm not going to whatever. But the point is that there are contingencies that weigh into this. And wrongful birth falls in a slightly different realm. But again, these are tort liabilities. And torts, remember, are civil wrongs. Radina.
Thank you. I'm wondering, so if, I'm not really sure how this works, but if the children were allowed to sue their parents and somehow this ended up...
Yeah, you didn't give me some M&Ms. I'm going to sue you. My quality of life is not any good. Yeah, go ahead.
That's tragic. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
If they do that and it winds up in the Supreme Court, can it?
State Supreme Court.
It can't wind
state
up.
State. No, it's a state law. State Supreme Court. Charles.
Like, what about like if a kid is born?
What about like what?
If it.
Like what? Like.
What would be
like,
the
huh?
the
what?
Difference?
Like?
What would be the difference if a child was born into like severe
to
poverty?
Life. Is that a new genetic? Is that a new gene? The like gene?
I like
go ahead,
it.
Charles.
No, if a child was born into like severe poverty or something, in that case where like their quality of life isn't.
Well, you could make all kinds of arguments, one way or the other, but I'm just raising it. Go ahead, Sky.
While she gets the mic, who usually wins those cases?
I think more and more, as you'll read and you look these up, the legislatures are prohibiting these cases. I think because it raises all kinds, it's a red herring.
It's kind of ironic.
Yeah,
you're
so they're trying to deal away with this more and more. Yeah.
If a child is born in a state that does have a law prohibiting the wrongful life or birth suits,
mm-hmm. could you sue in another
move,
state?
Yeah, if
no.
they move, it doesn't apply.
No, even though there's full faith and credit from one state to another, in this case it wouldn't operate. Okay, let's go into another aspect, and I want to wrap this stuff up because I want to talk about something else before we leave today. So there's also laws that deal with, of course, the testing agencies. And there's laws dealing with genetic counselors in the state of California. But, you know, there's also federal regulations. So you can't just test, you know, for these genes if you don't have a laboratory that's not approved by both the Food and Drug Administration on the federal level and, let's say, the state equivalent. So if you're going to set up a DNA testing agency, you better get approval from your state agency and from your federal agency. You can't just do these things willy-nilly. And furthermore, the equipment that you're going to use also has to have some kind of approval by the Food and Drug Administration, because generally these equipment would be involved in interstate commerce, and so therefore it would fall under probably the Food and Drug Administration, the federal government. But you have to have these regulations in place. So there's some protection for laboratory services. There's some protection with respect to genetic counselors, because they have to have certain requirements, they have to have certain degrees, and all of those other kinds of things. So I'm not going to go on and talk any more about, for example, metabolic screening and metabolic disease, because we've talked an awful lot about this. You can look in your handout. I have every single solitary disease that's screened in every single solitary state and what they permit and what they don't permit. I have all of the laws in the state of California that deal with newborn screening and the clause that opts you out on the basis of religion, and you can keep that and read it because it's fascinating stuff. But what about insurance, employment, life insurance, and all these other things? Well, let me just condense all of this for you. You've got to really read these laws to figure out what's going on, because it ain't easy, as you might know if you've ever read any of these laws. But the point here is, in the state of California, you have protection of privacy for your genetic information, but it's considered no different than other medical information. So you're protected. If you go to a doctor, you go to a hospital, they do a genetic test, it's confidential. They can't release that information without your permission. So you have state California laws that protect you specifically against revealing your genetic information without your permission. Second, you have state of California laws that protect you from any form of discrimination by any health insurance company on the basis of a genetic disability and on the basis of a genetic disease. Okay? And that applies to both individual health insurance and group insurance. And if you want to know the specifics of that, you're going to have to read the law, because they're very complicated. But there are protections in place. Third, there's protections in place for life insurance, although it's a catch-22. You can't be discriminated against on the basis of any kind of genetic disease in life insurance in the state of California. But, and here's the big but, it considers a genetic disease the same as any other disease. Therefore, you don't automatically get life insurance if you have a genetic disease, nor are you prevented from the insurance company asking you to take a test. Because insurance companies dealing with life insurance ask you to take, you know, examinations. They want to know if you have, you know, heart disease and all these other things. So the point here is, they can't single out genetics by itself, but they can include these things under the purview of other medical conditions. And they can require tests. They have to pay for the tests. And they can refuse you life insurance, because obviously they're at risk in terms of someone's got to pay for these different kinds of things. And so there are protections on balance for both the insurance companies and the patients. But there's a lot of laws that deal with life insurance protection, health insurance protection, employment discrimination outlawed on the basis of genetics. Employers can't require, to a certain extent, genetic tests involuntarily, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. However, that does not mean you can't be required to take a test, like a gene test or a drug test, to get a job, because you have no constitutional right in the United States of America to employment. And many companies drug test. It's a voluntary thing, but you don't get the job if you don't agree. It's kind of like, you know, your driver's license again. And so I don't think any company really wants to test you genetically, except perhaps to avoid an occupational hazard. So the classic example of this is, if you're working in a metal factory and you had a genetic susceptibility to metal ions, which you might have, and couldn't metabolize them in some way, perhaps there's an overreaching interest for the company to test for sensitivity to certain metals because of particular genes, but I don't think you really have to worry about it too much because I think most of us are protected along those lines. So there's a whole slew of laws, and I'm not going to go into them chapter and verse because you can read about them as much as I can. Are there any questions? Yeah, Radina.
So in regards to physicians...
It's weeks of reading here.
In regards to physicians protecting your genetic information, if they find that you have some sort of fatal degenerative disease, or can they tell
Who's
your
they?
Family? The physicians. Can they tell your family about it, or is your... Like,
That's a really good question. It's an excellent question. So physicians, you know, are restricted and have to maintain patient confidentiality, and if they violate that confidentiality, you can sue them for tort liability, okay? Because they're releasing your information in an unauthorized way, which is against the law. On the other hand, there may be an overreaching interest of the physician to tell a spouse or to tell a child or to tell a sibling that there's some Huntington's dominant gene that's running, you know, in your sister or your brother or your husband or your wife, and that may affect in some way what's going to happen to their lives. And again, the laws are murky on this. There has been a precedent, and the precedent is in the state of California, and it was here at UCLA. And it was here at UCLA because a patient was being treated by a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist knew that this particular patient had very violent tendencies and would, in fact, commit some absolutely horrible things. And, in fact, the patient did, and the family subsequently sued the University of California and the psychiatrist, and the courts decided that it was correct, that in those instances, the psychiatrist had an absolute interest and responsibility to release that confidential information to individuals that might be affected. And so it's not an absolute rule. This was a very famous case, happened here at the Neuropsychiatric Institute in the 80s at UCLA. So it's, again, not absolute. It's case by case by case by case. And I can't make a generality on that, but does that help you? So there may be some circumstances in which those absolutes won't operate. And I think that's what's so nice about our legal system, in that it's a little bit flexible and it can bend, and it allows for these kinds of exceptions. Any other questions? And I'm going to wrap this up. Melissa.
When people do get genetic tests, do they sign something saying that the physician has the right to... I mean, because when you... As it applies to...
I don't think that would be something
psychiatry,
that would be... I think that most things that you get when you go to the doctors have these big, long forms that no one reads, but they basically say that, you know, you have the absolute right to privacy of your medical information. And many people consider genetic information to be no different than medical information. And so, yeah, it's kept confidential. But there may be some reasons that, you know, if you have a patient and you know they're going to go kill somebody, and you know for a fact that they're going to, even though you're treating them from some psychiatric disease, then I think you have a compelling interest to be able to reveal that to somebody prevent someone from
having
harm.
Yeah, that's why I was asking, because when you go to...
But Melissa, I can't answer that question because I'm not a physician and I don't know what physicians give to patients in that realm. So I really can't answer it. It's beyond my expertise. You know, and I'm not a lawyer. I can just tell you in general what would happen. Okay? Okay. What's up, Gloria? Okay. Let's turn to the most contentious issue and wrap all of this legal stuff up. There are state laws dealing with DNA testing in the criminal realm. That is clear. These are laws that are very different than the laws that I've been talking about, because all the laws that I've been talking about, genetic discrimination, employment, health insurance, life insurance, you know, newborn screening, all these things are really more medically related, confidentiality related. They have nothing to do with the crime. Individuals who are convicted of doing pretty serious stuff. And the laws vary from state to state, even dealing with DNA databases. And that is the ability to take someone's DNA and run a fingerprint. So let me just give this to you in a nutshell. First of all, everyone is in agreement, almost unanimously. Constitutional scholars, people involved in this on both a state and a federal level, that we have a Fourth Amendment to the Constitution that prohibits unreasonable rights, searches and seizures, and taking blood from somebody, or even a buccal cheek, is a search. That's been established by many, many, many precedents. It's a search. And for most instances, you need a search warrant. But any of you go on in constitutional law or study constitutional law, you learn that nothing is absolute. And there are exceptions in which people, for example, if they have probable cause, can search your car without getting a search warrant. Or if they have a suspicion that perhaps you have contraband drugs in your desk in your workplace, they can search your desk without a search warrant. And so there are exceptions to this. It's called special needs. And I'm not going to get into special needs because, again, constitutional law is a hobby, but I'm not an expert at it. But the fact of the matter is that there are those circumstances in which one could theoretically take a cheek sample or a blood sample from you and do a DNA test without a formal search warrant, although those are in a very, 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 very small fraction of cases. If, and only if, and here's the key here, I want you to listen to this, if and only if that evidence is going to be used against you in a court of law. So in most of those cases, got to have a search warrant, unless it's very unusual, or it'll be thrown out, because you have this wonderful Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. However, after that DNA fingerprint has been constructed and someone has been convicted of a felony in the state of California, it goes into the database and it stays there forever. Say that again. If someone commits a crime, just you learned from your wonderful play, you've got to have a search warrant, DNA testing is done, you're convicted, that DNA fingerprint's going to go into this thing called CODIS, Combined DNA Information Database, and it's going to be there forever. Or, for example, if someone is convicted of committing a felony in the state of California under current law, didn't involve anything with DNA or DNA testing or any of that stuff, once you get into that prison, they're going to jam that needle in you and they're going to draw the blood and do a DNA test and put your DNA fingerprint into the database. And that has been verified, validated by many cases. And it falls under a lot of different legal precedents, but here's how they work. Once you're convicted as a felon, the state has an overreaching interest in knowing who you are, because you're no longer, you know, just this civilian floating around. They want to know who your identity is. And in those cases, the Fourth Amendment no longer applies because it's not considered to be an unreasonable search and seizure to take your blood because of the fact that they're just using it for identification purposes and not using it in a court of law for evidence against you. And therefore, fingerprinting is something that's been going on for an awful long time, and a DNA fingerprint is considered no different than a thumbprint. And so therefore, a prisoner or a convict or someone convicted of a felony, whether you're a juvenile or an adult in the state of California, your DNA is going into that database and ain't ever, ever, ever getting out. And it's perfectly permissible under the state of California Constitution, federal Constitution, and it's been upheld by many, many, many court cases. You can read about it, just a sec. However, starting in the year 2009, in the state of California, anyone arrested for a felony, the DNA gets taken and goes into the database, not simply convicted. You're either arrested. Anyone arrested of a felony in the state of California, the DNA goes into the database. That's Proposition 69, which was enacted last year. So it's a constitutional amendment. What that means is that if you're not convicted, within 2 years, your DNA fingerprint must be expunged. But the burden's on you. Too bad. You got a petition to get it out of there. But you got a petition to get it out of the federal database, California database, Florida's database, Tampa Bay, Florida database, Los Angeles database. I mean, if you want my opinion, it's going to be pretty surprising if it's ever going to get out, but I think you can work hard to do it. Under the old rules, the judge required, if you were not convicted, that your DNA identity be expunged, but now the burden of proof is on you. Of course, it hasn't been implemented because it's 2009, so I want to be clear about this. There's many legal precedents that allow DNA to be taken from convicted felons without a search warrant. There's many legal precedents that allow that DNA fingerprint to go into a database, and there's a lot of legal precedents that, again, allow the state to take from these felons DNA involuntarily, so to speak. In the state of California, all felons, juvenile or adult, have to subject to this and have their DNA in a database. But as of 2009, anybody that's arrested for any felony, whatever that is, it could be like felony drunk driving or whatever, you have to submit to giving your DNA, your blood, to have a DNA test given for a database. That's the law in the state of California. Other states is different. That's the law. Now, there's federal laws that deal with this too, but since most crimes are not federal crimes, most of these laws are state laws, so keep that in mind. But there are federal statutes that require these things as well, but most of this stuff deals with the state. That's the status of that. Now, the flip side of this is that, and this is the good flip side, is that all evidence from the scene of a crime must be kept forever. And therefore, the flip side of this is that anyone convicted of a crime in the state, or felony, in the state of California has the right, if they're in prison, to petition the state of California to do a DNA test and compare it to those pieces of evidence which were on the crime scene. So there's a flip side of this. In other words, yeah, you give your DNA and you're stuck in jail because you did these horrible things and you should be there for the rest of your life if it's pretty horrible. But the fact of the matter is that if you think that you're wronged, and in some cases this happens, the evidence is still there. And you can petition the state and say, I want my DNA tested. And if it comes out that you're excluded, which you know happens, and we've talked about that, and I showed you a film in the Carrie Mullis film, that happens. And so there's this thing called the Innocence Project, which some of you may or may not know about, but you should look at it on the website. It's fascinating. And the Innocence Project is a bunch of law students and some DNA experts have come together, and what they're trying to do is use DNA evidence to exonerate people that have been in prison for 15, 16, 20, 25, 5 years, and there's a number of individuals. And why is that? It's because, as you know from your court case, eyewitness testimony is highly suspect. It's not very good. Oh, I saw this person. Yeah, well, how far away, and was it light and dark? And but yet many people have gone to jail. And you know that our system is geared toward protecting the innocent people as much as possible, and it's always been that if one guilty person goes free, it's better than 5 innocent people or even one rotting in jail for the rest of their life. Are there any questions? Radina.
How is it constitutional for the 2009 law? How is the 2009 law constitutional?
I can't hear you. Is the microphone on? Yeah, we'll speak louder.
How is the 2009 law constitutional in California?
Because it was voted by the people of the state of California.
Right, but I mean,
it's a constitutional amendment. It's constitutional because it's an amendment.
But under the federal constitution, under the federal constitution, doesn't it violate anything?
No.
No?
search and seizure?
There's federal laws that do the same thing. It's not considered an unusual search and seizure anymore, from my reading, to use your DNA as a fingerprint. If it's used in a court of law as evidence against you, it becomes a whole different matter. Nico.
Yo, what exactly...
This is all new stuff. Someone's going to, you know, test it in the courts, but it's all new stuff. Nico.
What are you saying that the problem is exactly with if you got arrested and your DNA fingerprint is stored in a database?
If you get arrested for a felony...
And you didn't commit it, but your DNA...
If you get arrested for a felony and you're innocent... And you go to trial, the DNA is in the database, and let's say you're not convicted.
But why should I be worried that my DNA is in a database?
Well, some people might. Some people might be worried because, you know, some people want to keep their genetic information confidential and not used by the FBI and used by others. There's a lot of people who feel that privacy is something to be highly protected, and there's nothing more private than your genetic information. So there's a lot of people that feel that way.
I also remember Harry Klan said that you could get a hit in the database to an unrelated case. They take your DNA and like things can come up with that.
Right, that's the reason for having it in the database, sure.
Well, but he said, like, connected to something maybe you didn't do.
Be specific.
He had said that...
Just ask me a specific question, because Harry's not here and I don't remember what he said.
Commenting on taking the database.
Okay, so go ahead. Ask a specific question.
Did you have a question? I didn't have a question.
Karina.
Can the police go to, a hospital where a suspect may have gotten a DNA screening or a test and obtain his information?
That's too vague for me.
If they want his DNA information and he's not giving it up, can they go to a hospital and get it from the hospital where he may have
gone? The law says that you have to give a sample of your blood. It's not voluntary. Starting in 2009, okay? If you're arrested for a felony. And so that means that someone's going to... So you have no choice whatsoever. Now, they're going to do that themselves because it's so easy. You know how easy it is to do that. So they don't have any choice. The state of California made that a constitutional amendment. Go ahead, Charles.
I'm not sure, but I think her question was that if you bled somewhere, let's say you had a bloody nose and then
I can't answer that question.
Okay. Is that what you were asking?
I can't answer that question. You know, something like go to the hospital and grab some blood.
Yeah.
Probably, yeah, but I don't really know.
Saw it on a TV show once.
Becca, go ahead.
Is the same process for having your fingerprints expunged? Does that also hold true that you have to petition for it?
I don't know.
Okay, well, because I was wondering.
I don't know because we all have our fingerprints in the Department of Motor Vehicles, so. You know, I don't really know what happens with that or who has access to that. I'm assuming that it goes into, anyone can look at it for, crime reasons or whatever, the FBI or the police or whatever. So I'm not really familiar with that. It's getting way beyond my expertise. Any other questions? Okay, let me turn then to a new topic. I want to turn to the topic of races in an indirect way. And I want to get into something which deals with DNA and deals with genes, but deals with something which is probably more misunderstood and more tragedy has occurred, as all of you know, because of this thing called race. I can think of nothing more tragic in the whole history of humankind than all the tragedies that have happened because one individual group didn't like another individual group or one group discriminated against another group or whatever. We don't have to go into all of the history of this. We don't have to go into all the tragedy. The fact of the matter is it's based on false science. It's based on wrong science. It's based on anti-science. And in many cases, it's used for very, very horrible, horrible, horrible purposes. So the question really is what is the basis of this, if any? And I could give you the whole history, but I'm not going to, of where race even came into play and when it came into play. But what I want to do is talk about this in the context of the human genome, conceptually. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. But I also want to talk about it in the context of what we now know from the Human Genome Project and what we now know from this HapMap project and what we now know from sequencing the genomes of over 300 to 400 individual people representing different ethnic backgrounds, different geographical backgrounds, different, quote, racial backgrounds, whatever that means, and tell you a little bit about the results in a nutshell so that you can see exactly that there really isn't really a thing called race when we come to human beings. I mean, the punchline is the apex of genetic engineering, the apex, is being able to clone the human genome. The apex of genetic engineering is being able to sequence the human genome. You can't sequence it without cloning it. We've talked about that. So we genetically engineer, we learn how to sequence, you learn how to sequence the entire human genome. Once you get to that sequence, you can now understand who we are and what we, how we have originated as a people, where we come from, how we're related to each other, and how we're related to other creatures on the face of this earth. All of the information lies in your genome. It never goes away. It's immortal. It's there forever. It never disappears. The chromosomes that you have can be traced back millions of years to the primitive primates that gave rise to human beings, or can be traced back to our ancestors hundreds of thousands of years ago. Your chromosomes and your DNA can be able to be used in order to do that. And what I want to say here is just a preface. This is not a mystery, as I've talked about many times in this class. This is not hocus pocus. You know, when you have the sequence A, G, C, T, G, 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 there's no mystery with that sequence. And when you can compare that sequence to a fossil that lived 27,000 years ago, and you can compare it and get exactly the readout of the same genomic region, that's not a mystery. It's based on good science and the scientific method. And so the fact of the matter is that there's so much data that's accumulated, genetic data, but now DNA sequencing data, as I'll show you and share with you, that it's absolutely clear, beyond a shadow of a doubt, conceptually, that all of us arose in Africa 200,000 years ago, and that we started migrating out in different groups 50 to 60,000 years ago. There's just no question about that. Now, you could question the form, you can question how it happened, you can question specific things, but this is the most exciting area, in my opinion, of science today, that is using genomics and molecular biology and genes to trace human origins and the origins of specific groups and see the relationships between specific groups. And even groups that are at loggerheads with each other and are pounding on each other's heads, as I'll show you, hopefully, like the Israelis and the Palestinians, it's very ironic that when you do this kind of analysis, they turn out to be exactly the same and derive from exactly the same individuals and entities and have almost no genetic differences between them and come from the same common ancestor. It's ironic, isn't it? And that can be said for many, many other groups that have been trying to kill themselves for a very long period of time. But from a genetic point of view, there's really no difference. What am I saying here? Because I'm conceptualizing. What we've learned from sequencing the human genome, and now it's not sequencing one genome, but we're talking about sequencing 400 individual people's genomes. That's a lot. What we've learned is that all of you have exactly the same genes. There's no difference, except in the variation between you, the alleles that you have. And we talked about this almost 9 weeks ago. We're all the same genetically, obviously. You know, we all have the same genes, but we have different variants of those genes. But what you don't know, and what I'm going to share with you, is something which is counterintuitive. And that is the genetic variability that exists in human populations. That genetic variability, for the most part, arose 100 to 200,000 years ago. We're just using that same genetic variability and accumulating new genetic variability. And so what I'm saying is that every single population on this earth, whether it's Africans, whether it's Caucasians in Norway, whether it's people in other parts of Europe, whether it's Latinos in South America, those groups have exactly the same genetic diversity as any other group. I'm going to say that again. That the differences in the alleles in those populations, that is, if you look at allele 1, allele 2, allele 3, allele 4, allele 5, for every single gene in the human genome, for the most part, every one of those populations has all of those alleles. The difference is in the frequency of the alleles. The difference is in the frequency of those alleles. And the frequency of those alleles that we categorize as racial characteristics is 10 to the minus 9th percent of the genes in your genome, meaning it's like five genes. And think about all of the human tragedy that's been perpetrated on human beings in the name of racial purity, in the name of group identity, in the name of my group is better than your group, on the basis of just nothing. And so what we learn from genetic engineering and from its counterpart sequencing genomes is that we learn for the first time, really, with the precise genetic code, we learn that we're really not that different. In fact, we're not different at all. So I want to say that again because I'm conceptualizing a lot of stuff. If you look at the diverse alleles in any population that's isolated from another population in the world today, you will find those diverse alleles are present in all populations for the most part. The difference is in the frequency of those alleles. And furthermore, those alleles which differ significantly between populations are in the minority, the vast, vast, vast majority. Most of us in the populations that we come from have alleles in about the same frequency as if we have as another group. And so what I'm saying is that the genetic variability within a particular group, let's say black Africans from a certain region of Africa, they have as much genetic diversity as white Caucasians from a certain area of Norway. There ain't any difference. The difference is just in a few genes that give rise to skin color, facial characteristics, or hair texture. But this is just a few. And so there's just as much genetic variability within a group, no matter what the group is on the face of this earth. That's really a fascinating thing. The amount of genetic variability that's contributed to between group differences, like between racial differences, is 5% of the genetic variability. 95% is present everywhere. So what I'm saying here is if there was some horrible tragedy, some horrible, horrible pandemic that wiped out every single solitary human being on the face of this earth, except maybe, let's say, groups of people that live in some part of South America, let's say, you'd only lose about 5% of the genetic variability in the human genomes over the average of all of human beings on the face of this earth. That's nothing. It'd be a horrible tragedy, don't get me wrong. But, I mean, it'd be awful. It'd be horrendous, actually. But from a genetic point of view, the human line would perpetuate itself and be still successful. And that's why the concept of races is nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. Sure, people have different facial characteristics. Look around this room. It's obvious. People have different features. People have different skin textures. But it's like five out of the 35,000 genes that we have in the human genome. And why do they have different facial characteristics or skin characteristics or whatever? Because they're isolated populations. And a certain allele happens to arise spontaneously by mutation. And those populations are geographically isolated, at least reproductively isolated. And those alleles are perpetuated in those populations. And that's why you have these different features. But in terms of the gene pool, in terms of the diversity of alleles in any of those populations, it's absolutely insignificant. What do you think about that, Heather? Probably never knew that. So when someone talks about Aryan superiority, the diversity of genes in the Aryan pool ain't any different than the African pool or any other pool.
It seemed ridiculous to me before, but I mean, it's kind of neat to have something to back it up with. We were actually talking about this at my work the other day.
Mm-hmm. I know it seems ridiculous, but I can think of about tens and tens and tens of millions of people that have been killed and are still being killed on the basis of this exact thing. David, my man. And then we're going to talk a little bit about science. I've just given you the nutshell.
Did you mean Chris?
I meant Chris. I looked at David. I looked at Chris and I called David.
Can you tell me what is a race?
Well, I think you can define one. I think, you know, scientifically one would define a race as perhaps a geographically isolated entity in any animal or plant which has some kind of characteristics that can be used to distinguish that, let's say, geographical isolate from some other isolate. What those characteristics are could be anything. For example, it could be lactose intolerance. It could be, you know, whatever. It's arbitrary.
Well, I'm just wondering what notion of race we're undermining with
this. It's a sociological notion, basically. We've used it in a sociological context. There are scientific contexts. There's no question about that. Just as one can define a species as groups of organisms that are reproductively isolated from other groups of organisms and can't crossbreed. I think one could come up with races. I mean, there's certainly races of particular... What's going on? Oh. I think there's certainly, you know, you could say that there's a certain kind of race of an Arabidopsis plant, which we work with. You know, you could call it the Landsberg erecta race, and you could call it the Washaluska race, etc. I think we could define that. But when it's used in a sociological context, the question is, what criteria do you apply to define your race when most of the genes and the alleles are exactly the same and in the same frequencies in all of these different groups, except for a few?
All right, so if we have a bunch of stipulative definitions of race, what is it here when we say there are no races? What is it that there is none of?
I would say that there's no races from the point of view of all of us having all of us having the same genes, and in populations of human beings having almost the same frequency of all the different alleles. And so from my point of view, we ain't that different. And I would also say that if we had admixture, which we're going to, if we have lots of admixture, there won't be such a thing as race because we'll all go towards the mean. I mean, there'll be people with darker skin color and light skin color, but we'll go towards the average. And that's what I think we're heading towards as humans migrate in different parts of the world and people from here go there and they intermarry and have children and all of that. So I think eventually you have more of a homogeneity, so to speak. There'll still be a broad spectrum. But I think from that point of view, then what do you call race? Under our sociological definitions, we have, you know, blacks and whites and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But in reality, it's much, much more complicated than that.
Okay.
So I don't like to define it, quite honestly.
Yeah, that's what I'm just wondering about. I mean,
yeah.
What is the sociological definition?
I mean, mongoloids, caucasoids, negroids. That's where it originated. By a guy by the name of Blumenbach in the middle of the 18th century because he went to Mount Caucasus in Russia and he thought it was very beautiful. And so he says, you know, I think the people that live here are the most beautiful people of all. He wasn't a racist, by the way, actually, but it was used, his code, Blumenbach. He collected bones and skulls from people all over Europe, but he didn't do it in any racial way, and there's nothing in Blumenbach's writing that has any racist origins or anything. In fact, quite the contrary. He was just trying to understand the origins of human beings and trying to classify them like Linnaeus classified plants and animals. It wasn't until the 20th century where Blumenbach's precepts were sort of turned upside down in a really formal way. I'd say maybe before that. But all these things come down to culture and sociology and not science. Questions? Okay. Let's talk about the human genome conceptually. What I'm going to do is I'm going to conceptualize a lot of things for you. They're all in this handout in glowing detail that I finished about 6 this morning because I was trying to conceptualize a lot of things. But let me give you the punchline here. Let me give you some surprises. That's what I like to do. But I sort of conceptualized the message that I wanted to give you. First thing is that you have two genomes in your cells. When we talk about the human genome, we're talking about the genome in the nucleus and the genome in the mitochondria. Remember, we talked a little bit about this. The mitochondria, which generate the energy, which allows me to talk and allows me to do all the things that I'm doing now and you, that energy is generated in the mitochondria. And so there is a circular DNA in the mitochondria, which is associated with the mitochondria and which is transcribed, and its proteins are produced in the mitochondria. And part of the mitochondrion, this little bag of membranes in your cells, has genes which contribute to its structure. But it's only, you know, like 16,000 base pairs. It's pretty small in relationship to the genome in your nucleus, which is over 3 billion base pairs. But the fact of the matter is that we have a mitochondrial genome and we have a nuclear genome. And both of those genomes can contain and do contain, obviously, disease genes. Mitochondrial genome is in the cytoplasm, and it's a circle of 16,000 base pairs and only a few genes. The nuclear genome is in the nucleus, many billions of base pairs and 35,000 genes, both of whom have been sequenced, as you know, and there's really no mysteries about them. What you should be aware of is that when you clone these animals, these clones are mosaics. When you clone these animals, the clones are mosaics because they contain the mitochondria of the egg donor. And then if you fuse a cell with those eggs, which you do in animal cloning, those cells have mitochondria from the cell that you're trying to clone, so to speak. And so in general, these clones that are made are clones with respect to the nuclear genome, but are mosaics with respect to the mitochondrial genome, because the mitochondrial genome does replicate. The mitochondria undergo a very primitive division process, fascinating one. So the fact of the matter is that when you get these animal clones, or let's say a human clone, if we made one, it would be mosaic for the mitochondrial genome, but it would not be mosaic with respect to the nuclear genome. And keep that in mind. So a clone is not absolutely a clone from this point of view. And I also want to share with you the fact that, as I said, these mitochondria, which you can see up here, they have a genome. It's a small genome, but they have genes, and many of those genes can give rise to very serious human genetic diseases. And as we've talked a little bit in this class, these diseases are, in fact, inherited. How, Shauna? How would a mitochondrial disease be inherited? Yeah, they're maternally inherited. They can't be passed on by the father, as we've discussed, because the sperm don't have any mitochondria that go into the fertilization process. So you can see then, on the next page of your handout, you can see that we have a pedigree, and you can see that all of the children, essentially, of the individual with a mitochondrial disease, all of this is inherited in a maternal fashion. And in fact, this is very important for tracing human lineages, because we could trace all of your history back, at least those of you that are females in this room, to a common Eve, quote unquote, by using, you know, your mitochondria. So the mitochondria provides a record of human origins going back to the first Eve, because all of the mitochondrial genome is immortal, and the first human being had that mitochondrial genome, and that mitochondrial genome has survived all of these hundreds of thousands, and in fact has survived since the origin of eukaryotes, you know, billion or so years ago. And in fact, you can get a fingerprint of the mitochondrial genome, and there it is. It's very simple. This, Kyle, would you expect a lot of fragments if you digested the mitochondrial genome with a restriction enzyme, or a few fragments, Kyle?
Few.
How many on average if it's 16,000 base pairs and you cleaved it with, let's say, ECHO R1? 4, 3, 2, 1,000? How many would you think?
I don't remember how big the restrict... the
4,000.
Hmm?
On average, the size is 4,000 bases. So would you have just a few or a lot?
Wait, on average, the size of what is for that?
How many restriction fragments would you get if you digested the human mitochondrial genome, which is 16,000 base pairs in length, with an enzyme that recognizes 6 base pairs and the base composition is 25%, 25%, 25% AGCT for the recognition site? Lot of fragments or little number of fragments?
A little number.
Like 2 or 3 or 4 or 40?
The lower end.
Yeah, 2 or 3. You could do that calculation, though, couldn't you?
Yeah.
I hope so. In any case, there'd be a very few. And so when you digest the mitochondrial genome, you can see the restriction fragments directly. You don't need to do a DNA blot or anything like that because, you know, it's a very small genome. It's like a plasmid, basically. And so you get a particular fingerprint. And that particular fingerprint will be an indication of the identity of that mitochondria. And if mutations, as you will see, have accumulated over these thousands and hundreds of thousands and billions of years, you can use those mutations to trace back human origins. And in fact, if you participate in the Genographics Project by National Geographic, part of what will be sampled and can be sampled theoretically is your mitochondrial genome and what those variants are. And that'll make more sense in a few minutes. But the point here is that the mitochondrial genome is very important in terms of a few human diseases, but it's very important in tracing human origins. Now, one of the things that Dr. Evans didn't talk about is that because you have mitochondrial diseases, and those mitochondrial rely in the cytoplasm, that it's possible to use the cytoplasm of a donor egg in vitro fertilization cycles that have normal, healthy mitochondria. And so if you have normal, healthy mitochondria, they can produce the functions that a diseased mitochondria can't produce, even if they're in the presence of the diseased mitochondria. And so if you have a mitochondrial disease, you can prevent your children from having it either by not reproducing and passing your mitochondria on, or having cytoplasmic replacement, where you get a donor. The donor gives you her cytoplasm, which is normal, and that cytoplasm is injected into your egg along with a sperm so that you get an in vitro embryo that has the mitochondria from a donor, mostly your cytoplasm, and of course it has the genome of the father and has your genome as well. And so you get a mosaic as well, but in this case, the child will be healthy because the normal mitochondria override all of the defects that are present in your defective mitochondria. It's a very nifty, nifty technique. As I said, and I'm not going to review this, going to come to it in a second, is that you can use the mitochondrial genome to trace back human origins back to the original Eve. And you do this simply by following, as you will see, genetic variability that arises as migrations occur. And the assumption here is, and here's the conceptual part, the assumption is that you're dealing with markers. Markers mean big A and little a, big B and little b. These are markers. If it's big B, big B, you don't have a marker. Agree with that, Josh? In order to have a marker, you have to have something which is different. Do you agree? Tall peas, short peas. Remember, I started on this almost 9 weeks ago. Yellow tomatoes and orange tomatoes. Those are markers. If all the tomatoes are orange, you'd never know that there was an orange gene. The only way you can learn anything is having differences. And differences are the markers. And the markers in the case of genetics are these alleles, big A and little a, big B and little b. Now, in using these markers to trace human origins, whether they're in the nuclear genome or in the mitochondrial genome, you trace when the marker occurred. That is, you trace when in time an allele, if the gene is B, you trace when in time the little b arose. That's the key. And the assumption here is that all of the genetic variability that occurred in the ancestral genome, whether it's mitochondria or nuclear, will also occur now, most of it, because it doesn't go away. Once you have big A, big B, and little b, generally little b doesn't go away unless it's selected against. But let's just say there's no selection pressure against it. So that means that in this ancestral pool of people, you'll have big B and you'll have little b in that population. And you're also going to have big B and little b in the population of human beings that survive now. But as humans migrated from the ancestral human population, perhaps A mutated into A. So at some point in history, now we have an A gene plus a little a gene, whereas down here we only had big A and big A. Now we accumulate a mutation in A at this point in history. So now this population has big B plus little b plus big A plus little a. Now at this point we get big C mutates into little c. So now this population has big C and little c, et cetera, et cetera. So conceptually, by following what markers occur in what is considered to be the ancestral population, and what new markers arise as populations migrate out of one place, one can trace the origins of humanity. And you can do this with the mitochondrial genome. And if you do this with the mitochondrial genome, you trace it back to the ancestral Eve. Now, it's not one person, obviously. It's a population of women, but you trace it back to the ancestral Eve. And you can do this because any of the markers that occur in the putative ancestral population will be in the current population now. And that's how that's done, both with the mitochondrial genome and with the nuclear genome. And that's what's known as haplotype, let's say, mapping. And these haplotypes for haploid genotype don't look simply at one allele, but they look at a whole bunch of alleles. And I'm going to talk about that in a second. A bunch of alleles that are inherited as a unit. But remember, the mitochondrial genome is a circle, so all of the markers on the mitochondrial genome are inherited as a unit. And so therefore, the mitochondrial genome would consider to be a mitochondrial haplotype. And what I mean by that conceptually, Nick, is that the types of alleles that you have on your mitochondrial genome is a haplotype. The kind of alleles I might have on my mitochondrial genome would be a different haplotype. And those haplotypes are groups of alleles on the mitochondrial genome. A, little b, big C, little d, big E, little f, that's a haplotype. A, little b, C, little d, big E, f, that's a haplotype. And my haplotype could be different from Daisy's haplotype. Daisy's haplotype could be different than Sky's haplotype. And generally those haplotypes are going to depend upon the origins of where we came from in this room. But the original alleles have to be in the original population. And that's how people can draw this chart of the migrations of humanity tracing back to Africa, because all of the diverse alleles in the African population with respect to mitochondrial diversity are also found in everybody else. But then new ones arise. And some new ones arose in North America through migration from Europe. Some new ones arose in Asia and then in North America from migration from Asia. And that's how we can trace where the people came from. It's not traced on fossils. It's not traced on any. It's traced on your genes by directly measuring the sequence of the genes in these populations. It's very powerful and very important. So that's the mitochondrial genome. I should say that the results from the mitochondrial genome agree perfectly well with the results from the nuclear genome, because just as we can trace back to the common Eve, Jordan, how do we trace back to the common, how do we trace back to the common Adam?
I don't know. I have to find something that was passed down on like the Y chromosome.
Yeah, so you'd have to pass something down on the Y chromosome. So you can find the primitive Adam by doing Y chromosome haplotyping. So you'd follow the haplotypes, the gene variability, the different alleles that arise from the Y chromosome. And that's pretty easy these days since the Y chromosome has been sequenced, and one can do that. And if you follow the Y chromosome, you wind up in exactly the same place. You know, that's the scientific method, independent confirmation of the same results by totally different methodology. So if you do one thing using the mitochondrial genome, you do another thing using... It's fascinating stuff. The Y chromosome, you wind up with exactly the same results. What do you think about that, Lota?
I think that's pretty amazing that you can find where everybody comes from.
So if I took a little bit of your DNA, I could trace exactly where your ancestors came from, and I could give you a map that would route exactly where all of your ancestors came from. I couldn't tell you who they were, didn't tell you what they looked like, but I could trace them, and I'd be pretty accurate.
How much would that kind of testing cost?
$100.
$100?
Yeah. $100 to the Genographic Project. Go online. It's fascinating to do, believe me. Okay, so we have the human genome. This human genome has been sequenced. I'm not going to go into it. It's a fascinating story. It was sequenced in the public domain with federal dollars, but it's also sequenced by a private company called Celera. And there was a race between the private company and a race between the feds, people working in the public domain. And essentially, it boiled down to a tie, although it turned out that the federally funded human genome sequence was the one that was the best sequence, whereas the private sequence was one which is basically a skeleton. And I don't have time to go into why that is or what technically is behind that, but the fact of the matter is at the time it raised a lot of issues, because it raised issues of patentability and intellectual property, because Celera claimed that they were going to patent the entire human genome and therefore have a patent on every single entire human gene. But you know, of course, now that you can't do that unless you have functionality, so it wouldn't have been successful anyway. So they dumped their entire sequence into the public domain. And so there's two sequences, a public sequence and a private sequence. And I'm not going to go into, again, what the controversy was, but if you want to read a fascinating book, if you're interested in this, read The Genome War, which is absolutely fascinating. It's a story of the competition to sequence the human genome, private, public, and how President Clinton got involved and a bunch of other people to bring parties together so that everyone won out. But now all of this stuff is in the public domain. And I'm not going to go into how it happens or what it is. Conceptually, we have 35,000 human genes. You know from alternative splicing, we talked about that you can give rise to hundreds of thousands of different proteins. But the main conceptual point is that only about half of human genes are of a known function. So any of you who are excited about working on human genes, there's a lot of work to do, because we don't know the functions of 15 to 16 to 17,000 of those genes. And furthermore, we've only been able to correlate maybe 5,000 of these genes to human diseases. It's a lot of work to do yet. 10, 20 years of work till we find out what all of these things do, but more importantly, find the switches out and how they're regulated and all these other kinds of things. However, for those of you that are thinking philosophically, like Chris and Melissa, or those of you that might be interested in anthropology, or any of you might be interested in psychology, the human genome offers lots of prospects for you, Because not only has the human genome been sequenced, but the chimpanzee genome has been sequenced, the gorilla genome has been sequenced, the rhesus macaque genome has been sequenced, the mouse genome has been sequenced, the rat genome, the dog genome, the cow genome. That's a lot of mammals related to human beings, but particularly the chimpanzee. And the difference between the genomes of these individuals and humans provides the clues to what human consciousness is all about. There's no question about this. Because it's all in our genome. We just have to know how it functions, how it comes together to make our brains slightly different than the brains of, let's say, chimpanzees and other mammals that are closely related to us. So those of you that are interested in experimental psychology or any of these things, anthropology, you're going to have a lifetime of work to do, but a reservoir of information, because all of these sequences are available and are very, very exciting to work with. And in fact, there's only 1% difference or less between the human genome and the chimp genome. And in that 1% difference in those nucleotides, still a lot of nucleotides, resides the differences between human and chimp behavior, because that's the differences between us. And so what proteins are involved and how they function, this becomes something which is very exciting and the subject of a lot of work. Let me cut to the chase. Wrap it all up. As we sequence the human genome, we learn about the functions of human genes. We learn about the functions of human proteins. We learn about the origins of adults from embryos and from zygotes. We learn about the origins of human. We learn about everything. From a study of human genes, we learn about how we can become immortal. Don't make any mistake about this. Aging is due to destruction of genes. I have white hair for one specific reason. The melanocytes in my scalp have died and have stopped making melanin. That's a genetic process. We learn that process. We can counteract that process. Those of you who can discover a way to prevent people from having their hair turn gray are going to be awfully rich. I can assure you of that. Those of you that discover a way in which to keep the collagen gene on when you age, I've been noticing more and more wrinkles on me that I never had before. I'm not usually as vain as that, but I'm going, God, I never saw that before. It's because the collagen protein in your skin stops being produced, and that's why people get wrinkles. If you can figure out how that gene is kept on with age, you're going to be awfully rich. Beyond your wildest dreams. People are working on that stuff. But the fact of the matter is that if we understand how all human genes function, we can understand the basis of all disease. If you understand the basis of all disease, you can theoretically cure disease. That leads to all kinds of problems. We change because now we accept in vitro fertilization. We accept in vitro babies. We didn't do that before. But think about the fact that maybe people might be able to live beyond 120, 130, 140 years because we're now beginning to understand the genes that are involved in aging. Why do you age? Simply because you accumulate mutations in key genes. You mutate your own genome. If you could slow that process down in some way, one might be able to live to 120, 130, 140, or if one understood the basis of all these diseases that kill us, you wouldn't be killed by them. Now we have another problem. Sommer and I and David, well, I know about me, but God forbid, could live to be 200 years. That leads to a lot of sociological problems about employment, about carrying capacity of the earth, about everything. And imagine living in a society 500, 300, 200 years from now, it might be that if everyone could live as long as they could possibly live, although there'll probably always be new pathogens and stuff, it might be that you're only allowed to live for a certain amount of time. Well, you laugh, but people would laugh at in vitro babies 100 years ago. People would laugh at curing cancer 100 years ago. People would laugh at everything we're talking about in this room 100 years ago. If I said, oh my God, you could do a genetic test and prevent someone from having a genetic disease, they'd laugh. Sociology and culture changes with technology. When was the last time you used your computer, David? Could you live without email anymore? Could you live without the internet? I mean, we change. Things change.
I couldn't live without the internet.
So the point here is that it might be that as these breakthroughs occur, it might be, you know, you got 150 years and that's it, and you march out after that. And it might be perfectly socially acceptable. And in fact, in ancient cultures, ancient American cultures, old people were just left. And they were left just to die because they weren't considered, you know, fit anymore. And so that's a cultural example of what I'm talking about. And there are still cultures that in the opposite end, they have infanticide and stuff. And we don't agree with any of those things and wouldn't, you know, tolerate them in our society. But you never know what might happen many years from now. So the point here is that we have the key to everything. And one of the keys to that is identifying all the genes in your genome that are responsible for disease and, again, trying to understand human origins. And the key to all of that are these things called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, because this is responsible for all genetic variability. Orange and yellow tomatoes, tall and short plants, black skin color and white skin color. Charles, you think you got a different gene than someone that has a different skin color than you? You just have a different allele. Ain't being different. The point is that if you can understand these things, you can start tracing. And that's single nucleotide polymorphisms, generally mutations which occur by mechanisms that we've talked about. And so one of the most exciting areas of genomics and human biology now is to map, and it's already been done, map these single nucleotide polymorphisms along the genome. And now what I'm talking about in terms of single nucleotide polymorphisms, I'm talking about populations. Okay, populations. Because as you know, there's only two alleles in any one individual, but there could be hundreds of individual alleles from that gene in the population. And so when I talk about mapping all the single nucleotide polymorphisms, I'm talking about mapping the single nucleotide polymorphisms in the entire population of human beings. That's what I'm talking about. Nick, you look confused. Are you? That's what a polymorphism is. It exists in a population. And all of us have different mutations inside our chromosomes, and those mutations contribute to this genetic variability. And so in order to understand all the genetic variability that resides in the human genome, you have to sequence the human genome from many different individuals. Because if we only sequence Melissa's genome, we'd only learn about the polymorphisms in her genes, and there'd only be two, potentially, for each gene. But it wouldn't be what's representative of this room. And so in order to find out what's representative of this room, we've got to choose people to sequence, you know, anonymously, and that's what the HapMap project is all about. Because once you sequence the human genome, now you can look in every individual and group of individual on the face of this earth, and you can find where there are regions of variability, which are basically everywhere, in the human genome. But those regions of variability generally don't give rise to any phenotypes. Because as we talked about last time, most of those polymorphisms are either in introns or between genes. And it's only the ones that are in the protein coding regions that we look at that contribute to the phenotypes. That's what contributes to dark skin, light skin, you know, blonde hair, you know, brown hair, etc. Those are the polymorphisms in coding regions, and those are the vast minority. The vast majority of genetic variability and polymorphism occurs between genes or in regions that don't contribute to protein formation because there's no selection against or for, generally. They just happen, and they stay there. Because once they're there, they're there. There's nothing to get rid of them. And so if one could map all of these single nucleotide polymorphisms in the human genome, what does that buy you? That buys you the ancient chromosomes that gave rise to us. What it buys you is an ability to associate those markers with disease genes, because they might be linked to disease genes. What that buys you is the ability to associate particular disease alleles with maybe particular groups. That leads to all kinds of ethical problems. But what it buys you is the key to everything, because now you have markers of every gene in the human genome, and you have their origins. And so sequencing 400 individuals is no small job, but has been done by this HapMap project. And so what I'm saying is that we sequence these multiple allelic forms, and the only way we find all of these alleles in a given population is to sequence 400 human beings. And that's what's done. And this can be very important in terms of medicine, can be very important in terms of all kinds of things. You can read in your handout. I'm not going to go into it. You can learn about what genes involve susceptibility to drugs. You can learn everything. Nick?
Is there a variability as far as the size of introns between human beings? Like,
there can be.
I was wondering if...
It's not significant, though, because if there was, those particular genes wouldn't code for the right protein. So in general, no. But there can be differences in the size of introns of analogous genes in humans and chimpanzees. And the answer to that is yes, but not in humans, because they're very precise in where they're located, because they have to be spliced out. Are there any other questions? So we have this HapMap project. And how are these SNPs found to do this? They're all detected by sequencing or by chips that we talked about last time. So there's some pretty sophisticated technology. And these SNPs then can be used to genotype any of you by using a chip, or they can be used by sequencing. And the fact of the matter is that in this project now, there's so many of these single nucleotide polymorphisms that have been identified that they can be placed on specific chromosomes. And so what I'm saying here is that there's single nucleotide polymorphisms that have been placed every 500 base pair in the entire human genome. Think about that. In other words, we know the genetic variability of almost every human being on the face of this earth in 500 base pair increments in the human genome. So that means that we understand that there's a tremendous amount of genetic variability. Again, most of it doesn't contribute to protein formation, but we understand that, and we can use that. And if those SNPs are inherited as a unit on a chromosome, we can use that for a variety of reasons, but one of them is to trace ancestry. And there it is. So let's say that A and B, little a and little b, and big A and big B are single nucleotide polymorphisms. Mateus, what this says is that one chromosome coming from, let's say, your mother might have one series of alleles that are next to each other, and the one coming from your father has a different series, but we can trace those. And we can trace them because they're inherited as a unit. And I think that's better illustrated on the next handout, and there it is. And so what we have here is a region of a chromosome in which these single nucleotide polymorphisms have been mapped and sequenced. Notice that on one of them we have SNP1. There's a polymorphism, AT and GC. That's a different allele. The same locus, but now we have a variability in one nucleotide pair. We have TA, CG, CG, TA. There's another one. And here's a deletion of three base pairs, and that's another one. So we have three polymorphisms all together. These three polymorphisms will never be separated from each other by crossing over or recombination. They're too close. As genes and sequences become closer, recombining them becomes zero. So they're going to be inherited always together. This chromosome, GC, CG, AT, ATT, TAA, originated back when it originated. Could have been in the primitive Eve, or it could have been in the primitive Adam. It's always there. It never goes away. It's passed on from generation to generation to generation. And therefore, mapping these SNPs and having so many of them allows us then to trace human lineage. So look at that. We have these haplotypes. Notice that we have in those rectangles, slightly different sequences, but those slightly different sequences are at the same locus, the same region, of the same chromosome. They will never change except by mutation, which is rare, and they'll be inherited as a unit, and they can be used as markers now. Now we have a marker of identity. And so haplotypes are really the most powerful identifiers of identity that there really are. And now that you have all these SNPs, I mean, you could use this in DNA testing and to your heart's content, and you'd find only you and no one else, basically, by using this technology. So we have this HapMap project that I've been talking about. And I'm going to wrap this up. The HapMap project, Jessica, are you okay? I heard you back there. The HapMap project allows you to find out many, many things, but allows you to find out who we are and where we came from in the way in which I described earlier, only on a much grander scale. And it's because when this sequencing was done, it was done with, this is a paper that was just published last fall, there it is in Nature. There's probably 400 authors or more of this paper from centers all over the world, all done by voluntary consent of all the groups that contributed to it in a very sensitive, ethnically, culturally sensitive way. Everyone who contributes to this project does it voluntarily because they believe the results will be significant for humanity as a whole. So this is one of, I would say, almost the first all-humanity biological project that's ever been carried out. Because the only way this can be carried out is by a contribution from every different group on the face of this earth. And what we learn from all of that, and I'm not going to go over it, what we learn from all of that and how we learn it is the fact that we can trace, as I showed you earlier, our DNA patterns, either on the Y chromosome, the mitochondria, or on any chromosome, and we can trace these polymorphisms. And as we trace them, they accumulate. They accumulate but retain their ancestral polymorphisms. And I'm going to emphasize this again. When I say polymorphisms, Lisa, I mean in the ancestral population, you have orange and yellow tomatoes. And as that population evolves and migrates, the orange and yellow tomatoes stay there. But now we start accumulating green tomatoes and purple tomatoes. And as that population keeps going out further, we now get, you know, different color, pink tomatoes and all kinds of different colors. It doesn't matter what it is. But the point is, you can see the point. But the original ones were the yellows and the greens. I mean, yellows and the oranges. So we can start tracing with the accumulation of these markers, and we can place these things very nicely, and we get this map. What the genes, they agree with the fossils, but I don't really care much about fossils. I care about genes. And anyone who wants to argue that there's no evolution, frankly, is arguing anti-science because we don't go back to 5,716 years ago at 4 a.m. in the morning. I can assure you of that. We go back hundreds of thousands of years, and it's inescapable from all of these sophisticated studies of where we came from. Now, mechanistically of how we get there, it's a whole other deal, but we had a journey. There it is. And that's the outcome of genetic engineering. The outcome of genetic engineering, in my opinion, is not so much making insulin and making growth hormone and making transgenic plants. That's nice, but the outcome of genetic engineering ultimately is knowing what all of our genes do. It's back to immortality. The outcome of genetic engineering is knowing where we came from. The outcome of genetic engineering is to get rid of this atavistic attitude that we have towards humanity, at least some sectors of humanity, and recognize that we're all exactly the same and have the same origins. So stop fighting with each other because it doesn't make any sense. It's not rational. Of course, it's not rational. That's the outcome and the end of what we learn from genetic engineering, because in the beginning, You couldn't clone any genes. And if you couldn't clone any genes, you couldn't look at a gene. If you couldn't look at a gene, you couldn't understand what it does or where it came from. But the end result is knowing what all of our genes are and how they function and where they came from. And so when we look back, let's say 70 years from now, in the 100th anniversary of the history of genetic engineering, of when it was invented in 1973, it's a very, very, very important turning point in human history. Not only does it allow us to gain the ability to change ourselves from a genetic point of view, but it allowed the ability to learn what our genes do. It allowed the ability to learn where we came from. It allowed the ability to help cure us of diseases, help combat diseases, help understand why we, in fact, die when we do, and help us understand that we ain't any different. And all of that goes back to Cohn and Boyer, EchoR1, plasmids, PSC101, cutting, annealing, sticky ends, all of it goes back to that. And now we look and we see where we came from and where we're going. The question is where we're going. The question really becomes where we're going. I can't answer that question, because I ain't going to be doing this stuff for that long. But you guys will be answering that question. And so, as I told you 9 weeks ago, those of you that are not going on in science need to know what I've taught you. Because it's not just you at stake, it's what we use this information for, which is powerful. It is really powerful stuff. And you're just seeing, we're at the blastula stage in terms of how it's used. You haven't even seen the things that can be done with this technology. So those of you who are not going on in science hopefully now know from a scientific point of view how this stuff is done and what it might be used for. But those of you that are going to go on in science, in many respects, the future rests on your shoulders. Because you're the ones that are going to be making the discoveries that are going to be impacting the rest of us and that are going to be changing the way we look at ourselves from a genetic point of view. And I can say absolutely unequivocally, there has never, ever, 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 ever been a more exciting time to be in science. Ever. This is the most exciting time there's ever been to work on biology or anything related to biology, because we have the tools and the know-how to really understand everything there is to understand about humanity and every other organism on the face of this earth. And it all started way back when with Cohn and Boyer, and it all started with your little quizzes of cutting, digesting, annealing, transforming. It all started way, way, way back then. And that's why I've spent so much time trying to teach you what this is all about and what it means. And so therefore we come to the end. I'll see you all on Tuesday.